to the Overthinking It Breaking Bad Recap, Season 5, Episode 15, Granite State. I'm Pete Fenzel. I'm here in my Granite State gear with my little vest and my little unshavenness, because we've all been through a lot this week. I don't know how much more of this Breaking Bad any of us can take before we all curl up into a little ball, or before we need to go to a cabin somewhere and recuperate for a couple weeks. But we're still here with you. And whether you're watching us live on YouTube, listening to us on our Overthinking It TV Recap channel, please subscribe. It's a new thing. You're going to love it. Or catching us on YouTube after the fact through a replay, thank you very much for listening. We're glad to have you. The saga of Walter White has gone down to a very deep, dark place and has started to move somewhere else. And there's a little bit of left gas in the tank, a little bit of whiskey left in the glass. And I think it's time that we talk about, you know, where this is going from here. So I don't know. I feel somber. I feel somber today. I feel a little energy. But I got a big panel today. Sadly, our dear Shayna Malowski cannot join us due to illness this week, but she'll be back for the big finale or Felina next week. But I got a two brand new, very familiar faces. You've seen them before and Overthinking and heard them before. I'm going to introduce everybody in alphabetical order in the Overthinking at Grand tradition, starting, of course, with Ben Adams. Ben, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. You know, no matter how much Overthinking It you've got, you know, who can turn your back on more? So I'm doing great.
Excellent. Well, it's really great to have Ben on here. Ben, you did the Mad Men or the Game of Thrones recaps with us before?
Couple of the Game of Thrones, and then I did the Downton Abbey with Matt.
Oh, that's right. Downton Abbey with the saucy butlers. That was what I was joking about last week to try to take my mind off of the horrible human suffering that we were all watching. Awesome. And then next in alphabetical order, we have John Parrish, our old standby. How are you doing?
Hello. How's everybody doing? Drink.
Excellent. Oh, is that what kind of whiskey was that in the glass, John?
Oh, this is a screwdriver. We're low on whiskey this week.
Oh, okay,
this
cool.
This is orange in memory of the washed orange desert, of which we saw relatively little this week because we're in the blue, frosty northeast. But I don't know anything blue that would go well with liquor, sadly. So.
Oh, yeah. You got to get some good pre-workout. Get a good pre-workout mix into the blue drink, little chia seeds, you know, get your no-docs blasting and go hit those supersets. And, of course, Another special newcomer, but a very old comer for the rest of us, Matthew Rather has joined us for a Breaking Bad recap. Matthew.
We can recap like this.
No, Matt, you have to turn around. Matt, turn around. You're looking like a crazy person.
They're going back. They're about to bring my stevia.
Matt, rather, the podcast quality is 92%.
92%? I'll fix that.
So Matt actually has binge-watched the entirety of Breaking Bad during the last, what, like 4 or 5 weeks?
I did, I did the first three and a half in 2 weeks. At which point my girlfriend nearly died of Breaking Bad exhaustion. And I had to, like, even though it's like always a weird thing in a relationship when you're watching something together on Netflix for one person to pull ahead of the other, right? And, you know, and watch without them. I did anyway. And then watched these final few episodes on perfectly legal, no, I'm teasing. Don't steal content.
No.
Don't do meth, kids.
Well, this provides a very good transition into where I wanted to start the conversation out about Granite State. Now, it's not about kids not doing meth. Kids, you still can do meth. It's not that isn't worth talking about. But I wanted to talk about a little bit about watching this show until exhaustion, until you almost die of exhaustion, which I felt like was an actual theme in this week's episode, notable in a couple of places, most obviously tipped off, I think, in the scene at the vacuum cleaner repairman, where Saul literally looks into the TV and sees Walter White hemmed in a little cell, like slapping the light, right? And then sort of Saul does what we all dream of doing, which is he goes into the television, right? He goes into the cell with Walt, and we get to see their sort of attempt at this point in the story, after everything has happened, after all of these things have happened, their attempt to continue to do, really to continue to make the show Breaking Bad after all of the things that have been kept secret for so long, or all of the reckonings that haven't happened, have finally come to pass. I mean, I heard a lot of complaints on the internet about the scene between Walt and Saul because I heard that it wasn't good. But I sort of felt myself that it was not supposed to be good, like a good Breaking Bad scene, because the fact that it failed on such a basic level was a sign that the show could no longer go forward exactly the way that it had gone. Anybody else want to jump in and talk a little bit about Saul and Walt and sort of where we are at the beginning of this episode as we move into the rest of the story?
I'll take a swing at that one. I saw some of the same discussion that I think you're referencing, Pete, and I think the tone of that particular scene was deliberately claustrophobic and uncomfortable. I think we're meant to see Walter White at what we think is his lowest point. As we can see, he obviously has much, much lower to go through the remainder of the
episode. Oh, yeah, he's a limbo star, people. This guy, Jack be limbo, Jack be quick.
Yes, very, very, very low. But we're meant to see him at what we think is his lowest point, which is this white featureless t-shirt, his arms looking scrawnier than usual, sort of pacing around, very futile and impotent, making extensive plans on the yellow legal pad, very much like a crazy person would do. This is noted crazy person behavior, making lists of enemies on a yellow legal pad and asking lawyers to hire assassins. Like, I know lawyers, and this is something crazy people do to them all the time. So,
wait, really? You know lawyers say crazy people ask them to hire assassins?
Well, crazy people ask lawyers a lot of things because they're crazy and they're lawyers. So, so they think that, like, oh, you know, the government is tapping my... Well, that's a bad example because that happens now. the government is hiring gangs of people to stalk and surveil me. Well, it's also... The examples are no longer as crazy as they once were, but you know what I mean. Like, if you're crazy and you think someone's out to get you, the first thing you do is, like, troll the phone book and call lawyers one after the other. Be like, oh, will you take this case for me?
Right. Ben, Matt, do you guys have any take on this scene? On the lawyer, yeah. On the lawyer-crazy person relationship?
What I got out of the scene was that, like, Saul is making a lot of sense here. He's like, he's done with the Better Call Saul lawyer, and he's now
well, just, to be fair, you yourself are in law school, right?
That's true. I aspire to be Saul Goodman.
you want to be a criminal attorney?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
This is what you have to look forward to, Ben.
Yeah, crazy people and their meth gangs. But like he's kind of laying it down. I mean, as he says at the end of his last line is it's over. That's his last line. I'm assuming we're not going to see him next week. He's telling Walt, this is done. Like, if you're being sensible, this is done. And then he lays out all the ways that it's better for Walt's family if he turns himself in. Like, that's his way out to actually do what's best for his family at this point. And I kind of saw a parallel with the season one episode where Walt gets the offer from Gray Matter to pay for all his bills. Like, that's what's best for his family at that point. Like, get the free money, get the bills paid for. You don't have to cook meth, but Walt can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is his last chance. This is Saul telling him, like, this is your way out to save your family. You know, maybe they can even stay in their house. Skyler won't go to jail, but Walt can't do it.
Go ahead.
I think the interesting thing about this scene is that the you know, the power. Oh, someone's breaking a cat. The power is entirely like fantasy power at this point, right? Like. Because he's so constrained. He's constrained in this little underground tomb. And that's, that was for me, that's one of the first kind of, prisons, right? Or like containment units in the episode, this underground one. Actually, the van, right, is one. The propane tanker that transports Walt to the Granite right. State.
So New Hampshire, yes, live yeah. or die. Yep.
And the fence that marks the property line around the couple acres in the in the woods and the 8 mile road down to a tiny town. Jesse's underground cell. And the fence that goes up the fence that goes up around Walt's house. I mean, the idea that things are fenced off, that we're fenced off from one another, and that, I mean, the particular, these aren't fences. There are fences meant to kind of keep people out and fences meant to keep people in, to kind of contain an evil, which is the idea of a prison. And ultimately the prison of your own body. Right, because this scene with Walt and Saul ends with Walt's body sort of betraying his grandiose fantasies of power and domination. It ends in a fit of coughing. You know, another callback to season one where it was like a symphony of coughing every damn episode. You know, so he can't. I mean, he can't sustain, like, just on a physical level. He can't sustain the kind of grandiose mastermind sort of thing that he fantasizes that he's capable of, which is, I guess, a trope of the show not being able to sustain kind of the level of activity, right? That was in the last episode, because last episode was so monkey balls off the wall. Just in terms of everything happened. And like this scene was like really about being sort of pent up or cooped up or kind of at your limits.
Yeah, exactly. I particularly loved that Saul sort of hung out there because he knows Walt and he knows what Walt responds to, hangs out the idea that Walt could be John Dillinger, right? When he walks into prison, you'd be the John Dillinger of prison. But of course, Walt doesn't want to be anyone else's name. He wants to be his own name. And of course that's sort of a close thing. But the idea of enclosures, I think this feeds into a big theme that we've talked about for the whole season, right? Was that in the different steps along the way throughout the season, we've been talking about the effects that different kinds of knowledge have on the way that people behave. And it goes back to, Hank knowing that Walt is Heisenberg. And then of course to the money that was seen in front of the headlights, which still strikes me as one of the most important sort of visual tropes and scenes, visual motifs throughout the entire season to sort of explain what's going on. And here, you know, in Ozymandias, we went from this same place where everybody knew what Walt had done, and there was a whole bunch of stuff that necessarily had to follow from that, to now we all know what has happened to Walt. Everybody in the story, at the very least, thinks they know the end of the story for Walt, and as such, that Walt's story has been sort of enclosed. Right, that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. That there's no way for it to keep going, and that I think a lot of the enclosures and hemmed inness are referring sort of narratively to the story that we're watching in terms of a show, but also in terms of a way that if Walt has a story that might keep going, there are people that might want to be on board with it. And it also sort of shows that the fact that people didn't know where Walt was going, and he always seemed to be going somewhere. He had an energy that gave him power, and that gave him an ability to make other people do things, which he doesn't have anymore because he can't move, right? And I thought that was reflected throughout. I mean, the Nazis, we can jump to the other big meta Breaking Bad watching scene, which is when the Nazis are watching Breaking Bad, and they're watching Jesse confess, right? And they're calling him a pussy, and they're saying all these nasty things about him, right? And they're laughing at him. Right. And it's like, well, their experience of watching the show is very different from our experience of watching the show, but they already know how it ends, or so they think. Right. And it's a comedy to them, I suppose. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, any thoughts about that? About there's also a bunch of bait and switches, I think, in a bunch of these different scenes where.
The comment they make a couple times on the in regards to the video is they call Jesse a crybaby at a couple points, mm-hmm. When he's talking about, you know, these murders and these things that he's done and all of that. And this is an episode that's sort of replete with a lot of different characters crying, not all of whom we've seen cry in the past. Like Walter is crying when he's on the phone to everybody, or when he's on the phone to Flynn. Flynn is obviously in tears when he's taking the call. Skylar is, you know, crying when she's being held up. So there's, I don't know, it's... Obviously, it's a very emotional period, so I don't know that that's necessarily thematic in any particular way, but it is a sort of like divulging or unfolding of emotion that up until this point had been pretty tightly pent up. Up to this point, it's, you know, we've let our guard down, we've lost our remaining masks and defenses. Now we can be openly honest and emotional with each other.
Yeah. He's talking about the very human experience of, I mean, in stories, the heroes, the villains, they keep doing stuff, right? We were talking about this in reference to the rabbit, was it Rabbit Dog, the episode before Ozymandias, or the episode of the Hank police procedural episode where Hank thinks he's going to get Walt.
Yes.
Right? And like the action is going and like, and we also talked about how that kind of came to a stop at the moment when Skylar cuts Walt's hand, right? And how if this were a real action movie or like a real action crime TV show, not real, but like really genre driven, just being cut on your hand wouldn't be enough to stop you.
Right.
But in this show, it has this compelling emotional quality. So to a degree, the show is criticizing and kind of trying to, you know, supplant a more kind of, I want to think about like you know what, like Human Target is a good example of a show where, I mean, you guys, nobody watched, I mean, not enough people watch Human Target, but like 24, right? Like the Jack Bauer way of living, where you take a bullet in the shoulder and 20 minutes later you're flying an airplane or whatever, right? Like, and this is a show where people have to stop and process and weep and mourn. And when people have nothing to do and nowhere to go, the story doesn't just stop for them. They suffer, right? And the idea that the Nazis, because they are sort of tauntingly carrying the story forward on their own, don't value this, right? They don't value the human experience associated with the story. They just sort of want to, they won the lottery. They just want to see the next part of the Weekend at Bernie's that they're on, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing, I mean, there's something a little more serious about that Nazi scene, which is that like Jesse violated the code, right? Like not only is he a, you know, crybaby or, you know, a big P word or something, right? Like, but he's, but then he ratted you out, Todd, right? Like, and that's actually
something that's the bait and switch I was talking about. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, sure. Yeah. And then, I mean, there's another bait and switch with Walt's phone call, and there's a, you know, another bait and switch with, you think it's going to be Walt in the minivan and it turns out to be Saul at the beginning of the show. Yeah, yeah. It's something, I mean, it's sort of something that happens a lot. And I hope it promises great things in store, because this was an episode that was kind of very quiet after a kind of after all the frenzied action of the last episode. And I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a little more frenzied action to come. I don't know. Am I bad? Am I like the legions of god awful Skylar White haters on the internet just to say that, you know,
Did you watch the end of the episode, Matt? I mean, that's exactly what the episode, that's the arc, right? Like we started talking about the episode being hemmed in, the story's over, Walt is done, you know, yeah. And because of all these things, everyone else is trying, you know, the people who want to keep moving, who are like the Nazis and the feds.
And at the end of the episode, the phone is swinging from the payphone cable. It's right. I think it's important that it doesn't get like hung up. You know what I mean? To like end the call, to put a thing on it. And then, so, I mean, I guess the cold open from episode 9, right, happens probably subsequent, is probably like the early part of the next episode, right? It happens almost immediately subsequent to what we see.
Probably.
Yeah.
It's also important there that last scene ends. I don't know that it's the only time, but it's the only time I can think of where the Breaking Bad theme song is used in
the
soundtrack. Episode.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's telling you that like, no, there's another episode of Breaking Bad coming. Like this is the beginning of a next awesome episode of Breaking Bad. Where, you know, he's going to do science all over the place. Like, I mean, that's like the promise of that theme music is like, nope, yeah. Heisenberg's got one last ride.
He has more bad yet to break.
Yeah.
We think we've seen him alienate everyone in his life, like his family, his wife, his son, his former coworkers, his lawyer, the Nazis, his brother-in-law. Like, we think we've seen him alienate everyone, but like, nope, show reminds us he's got one relationship left that he could possibly ruin.
Well, then, of course, Matt, you've been trying to get in. Go in, get in for it.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about something else, though. So let's.
Well, then let's say one. Can I say at least one more thing?
Please.
About this last scene, because I thought there was a wonderful little addition to a classic aphorism, which is that if you have a glass, right, and you have a little liquid in the glass, is the glass mostly empty, or is the glass like, well, what is it? Is it 7/8 empty, or is it 1/8 full? Right, like, and the question is changed if what's in the glass is a very powerful, very fine whiskey, in which case a glass that is only 1/8 full can still be a full glass. And I felt like that was what the that last shot was about, right? Was that, like, things look really bleak, but, like, if you want to be optimistic about it, we've got one more good thing to come, right? I thought that's why it was seemed very clear to me that we are being promised some action. But anyway, Matt, take it on. What's the next topic that you wanted to cover?
I mean, the thing that I wanted to say, I wanted to talk about criminality, right? Because I feel like the bad that wall breaks, and I feel, I'm sorry, I want to go into like a lot of overarching themes because I haven't had the benefit of being caught up on the show and being able to kind of talk with you guys about it for the last.
You just drank the whole cup of whiskey. You just poured yourself a giant, like, big gulp. You got the little hat with the little cans on the side, and you're just
Right, exactly. With like a, you know, a bottle of Jameson in each one, and a, you know, straws coming out to the. To the thing, but like it strikes me that Walt is evil, but he's not criminal, right? And like the difference between or he's a bad criminal, right? He's a good evil person, or he's rather a successful evil person. If being evil is a goal, he manages that, but he doesn't really ever manage to be a good criminal. And I think we like. See why. And he and Jesse are kind of tangential to a lot of criminal organizations, whether it's like Mexican drug cartels or Gus Fring's operation or the kind of international drug trafficking, almost like white collar crime. And now like the white power gang, prison gang. He doesn't belong, and Jesse doesn't really belong to any of those, because you know, if you come up in any criminal world, right, like it seems, and maybe this is just a trope of everything on television, but you know, this is a show that's self-conscious enough where I think that stuff obtains, right? You know, you don't rat out the other guy, you know what I mean? Like, you don't sell out the team or the thing or your fellow criminals, right? And that's something that you get, like, that's I feel like that's a criminal code that is like passed on through indoctrination, that is like a social norm as powerful as the incest taboo or something, as powerful as something like very, very basic to humanity in sort of organized criminal societies, for want of a better term. And so while Walt breaks bad, he breaks evil, right? Like, and Jesse, I don't know, was always kind of, I guess, small time criminal. Though, I mean, I don't know. Jesse sort of pays the price. I mean, Jesse is sort of the picture of Dorian Gray matter.
Jesse was always an outsider, is the thing. Like, he was never. I mean, he was obviously a meth cook for at least months and years before he ever reconnected with Walter White in season one. But he was never really in deep with the he was never really as connected to the criminal underworld as, you know, as Walt eventually became. And, you know, he was always an outsider. And this, you know, his willingness to go rogue, to go rat, essentially, and talk to the DEA is sort of proof of that. Like, if he had a good, strong peer group, like a support group of like-minded criminals and dealers and murderers and whatnot, he might not have ended this way, and things might have been better for him. Who knows? Yeah. But, I mean, that's the one thing Jesse has lacked in particular, especially over the last couple of seasons, is a peer group of any sort. Like, he doesn't have people he can connect to on any meaningful personal level.
He has no meth dealer mirroring. There's no, like, it's like an attachment disorder.
Well, and when, I mean, like, even when he's shot as kind of like staring blankly into space in like in 9 or 10, in episodes 9 or 10, where like Badger and Skinny Pete are over, you know, and and he's just like.
Yeah, the Star Trek stuff.
Exactly.
He leaves. Because he's sick. He's the sick Captain Kirk. Yeah, it's. I mean, I think it's connected to the idea of Walt being in the Empire business, because it's sort of necessary to be a criminal, to be a criminal in relation to a hegemon, right? Like, you have to be in violation of someone else's rules in order to be a criminal. And in order to sustain criminality, you need to be able to sustain that sort of dialectical relationship with an authority that you're violating. If you don't recognize anybody else's authority, then you're not really a criminal. And in that case, you're like, you know, in the NSA or something, right? Like, it's like, you know, it's you know, when I keep wanting to talk about like Karl Rove talking about Shakespeare, where, you know, he's like, everything that I learned about government and campaigning, I learned from Shakespeare. And the idea that, you know, you are a decider, you're this is an empire, we're framing the discourse, we're saying the way that things are going to go. It can't be illegal. It can't be, if you think of yourself as the source of all law, then you can't be breaking the law. And if you're a positivist in the sense of what I say goes and nothing else ever goes except for what I say, then you're not, you know, what statute are you violating? Right? Like certainly nothing. Certainly if it's you're the person who really gets to frame the way people around you think, then none of them are going to think of you as a criminal. Whereas Gus totally buys into this idea that he is living in other people's societies. And in fact, Gus has a ton of practice doing this because he had to move from Chile to Ecuador. Right. And then he went to Mexico and then he went to the United States. Right. It's like he's been this sort of wolf in sheep's clothing in a bunch of different situations. And he makes such a great criminal because he's so good at maintaining his own organization and operations in relation to like a hegemonic political legal discourse that he doesn't obey, that he is against, you know, that he violates. Right. And this is why codes and peer groups and stuff are necessary to all this stuff. I know, Ben, what do you think about all this stuff?
What I was going to say is what I think.
As a law student, of course. You know.
I mean, what separates Jesse from pretty much all the other major criminal characters is he has certain lines, stark lines, he's not willing to cross. I mean, the whole reason he's a crybaby to the Nazis is because, like, doing these terrible things tears him up inside. Like, he can't forget all of the horrible things that he's done or even been a part of. Like, he had nothing to do with the kid being shot. I mean, he had something to do with it, but, like, he absolutely didn't want that to happen. But he can't forget it. He can't let it go. Contrast that with Todd, who's like smirking when he hears about his crime being reported. Yeah. He's got like this smirk you just want to smack off his face.
Yeah, sort of like, oh yeah, this is the good part. Oh man, they're going to snap when they hear about this kid that I shot. Okay.
You know, everybody is the hero in their own story, including Todd, who's like, yeah, this is the awesome part. And like, you know, you were saying that, you know, last week or 2 weeks ago was like Hank's episode where he's writing his own story about catching the big criminal. Like, this is Todd's episode where he's like writing a story about all these badass things he does to secure his family, where he's like threatening people. And like, it's this weird morality. So to us, it's horrifying. It's a horror show.
And to end up with Lydia, right? At the end.
Yeah. But like to Todd, this is like a rom-com where like he's doing all these meet cute things to get the girl. But to us, it's just this horror show. Of, you know, nonstop.
So there's this scene where I get ice cream, right? But I don't just get one kind of ice cream. Like, I get two different kinds of ice cream. And it's peanut butter and it's Americone Dream, right? And I just, like, and I'm such a cool guy that I give him the ice cream, eat the ice cream in the little pit thing. Because, like, that's what I'm like. I've got a sensitive side, you know?
And that touches on one of the other themes I wanted to cover from the episode. Because it's something that comes up in two places explicitly and is sort of touched on at the beginning. It's the idea of, I didn't intend this as a pun, but getting your just desserts, as it were, getting what you deserve, like the rewards you get from cooking meth. This was an arc for Jesse early on, particularly in seasons 2 and 3, where the idea is like, oh, what is he entitled to from the meth cook? And there are points where Walter sort of sneers at him. It's like, you get nothing because, you know, Jesse walks out on him. And then he ends up giving him money anyway. Or where Jesse doesn't even want money. He just wants acknowledgement that he's as good of a cook. And Walt denies that to him at first, but then says, no, your cook is as good as mine. This is from many, many seasons ago. Here, Jesse is at his lowest point where his rewards for a good meth cook are his choice of half of a leftover Ben and Jerry's. Like, you get to pick which one you want. That is the rewards of what you've done. Contrast this with Walt, who is, you know, obviously at a low point. You know, he's abandoned in a shack in the wilds of New Hampshire, can't see anyone, can't interact with the world in any meaningful way. His only contact is Robert Forster, and even that Robert Forster himself acknowledges is very reluctant. So and he finally stumbles into town, you know, probably at great physical taxation to himself, and gets on the phone with Flynn and tries to plead with him to take money, and Flynn shuts him down. And in the exchange they have, he blurts out this one line, it can't all be for nothing. that's central to the Walter White character, that, you know, yet it's okay that I've done these terrible things. It's okay that all these tremendous harms have been done, so long as there was something for it, so long as there was a payoff. The idea that all of this was for nothing is the worst possible outcome to him. Just as, you know, Jesse being locked in the pit and fed ice cream and then seeing his girlfriend shot is the worst possible outcome for him. So it's like, this is the, you know, these are the wages of sin, as it were. This is the reward of meth cooking, not big stacks of money in a storage unit, not money lining the interior walls of a house before Skylar takes it and gives it to Sid Beneke. It's the wages of sin are like depravity and death and isolation and melting ice cream.
Yeah. I'll just make a quick comment that the viewers who are seeing us on YouTube, you can look at me and you can look at John and you can judge our relative enthusiasm for the ice cream and make your own conclusions. I thought John was bringing, oh, it's just ice cream, John. It's ice cream. It's not just ice cream. No, never mind. But yeah, so, gosh, I don't know whether we should go back and talk more about the Lydia romantic comedy and like Todd's Oxford shirt, or talk about the wages of sin and the ultimate reckoning of a man's soul. the episode, it kind of goes in both directions. Well, let's pose this. You know, the episode is called Granite State. I thought this was a really loaded title. I thought that in a lot of the other episodes, the title often would sort of point one direction and kind of go the other direction, right? Like, it seemed like it was going to be about one thing, but it was kind of about another thing. Or it was pretty clear about what its resonances were. But I felt like this one had a lot of potential interpretations. So what did you guys think about the fact this episode is called Granite State? What does that mean to you?
So I had a...
Yeah, Ben, you can jump in. Go for it, Ben. Yeah.
So I immediately thought of the season 5 premiere, which was titled Live Free or Die, which also references New Hampshire. So we have these two kind of contrasting bookending references to New Hampshire. And so Live Free or Die poses this kind of false choice that there's only two things that you can do. You can either live free, go out guns blazing one way or another, or you can die. But there's another way, which is the Granite State, which is kind of this like in the middle, which is worse than either one of those, because like Jesse wants to have that choice of live free or die. Like he wanted them to just shoot him at that point. Like he's either going to get over that fence or he's going to get shot, or at least that's what he wants. And instead he's in this middle state of he can't even pick between those two things. So it's I'm thinking that state has this dual meaning of obviously a state in the Union, but also like a physical state, an emotional state of being like crushed by granite. Mm. And Walt is in kind of the same position where he's enclosed in this tiny little place and he can't live free or die in that place. And he's being crushed by the weight of what he's done. And then of course, at the end of the episode, he's basically decided he's going to go pursue this live free or die. He's going to do one or the other. Then I think there's a lot of that, like Skylar's in a similar position where she's not really living free. She's not really, she's kind of in this in-between state between the two.
Mm-hmm. So Matt, John, do you guys have other interpretations, either similar or different interpretations of the show?
There's one reference that might be, this is probably a stretch and it'll mean more to New Englanders than most folks, but one of the, I guess you'd call it sort of tourist attractions or noted natural features of New Hampshire up until about 2003, was this rock ledge that loomed over Franconia Parkway called the Old Man of the Mountain, which was this series of like interlayered rock ledges that viewed from a certain angle kind of looked like an old guy's face. Mm-hmm. And been around there for hundreds of years. Like Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote a short story about it. In 2003, it collapsed. Now it just looked like cliff face, and you know, there's not really a face there. But to your point, Ben, about you know being reduced to a sort of granite state, a very rocky, stable state, we've commented before in previous episodes, especially the ones that sort of flashed forward to Walt's return to Albuquerque, that he looks craggier than usual, like he looks rockier. He's sort of returning to this very stable, rocky, like craggy state of sorts. So when I saw that, how like rocky and featureless rocky and wrinkled his face look, and now that he's sort of literally living in the mountains of New Hampshire, that sort of jumped out at me. Like he's becoming a mountain. He's becoming immobile. He's just sort of going to merge with the earth and then, you know, get covered over by snow and then be found months and months later by Robert Forster on one of his rare trips up. But yeah, as it turns out,
or by a traveler from an antique land, right, who said two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert.
OEO, walking like an Egyptian.
Yeah.
There were definitely times where Walt was in profile and was lit. And I can totally see, John, because also, if you've ever been to New Hampshire, the Old Man of the Mountain is on all the highway signs. All this, their sign for the state highway in New Hampshire is like the profile of the Old Man of the Mountain. So it's something you see a lot. And yeah, I mean, the idea, that image was definitely suggested throughout the episode, either specifically to correspond to the Old Man of the Mountain or just also to play off some sort of common ancestor of a sort of craggy profiled face in the light of like the snowy air, right? As like as a cultural object. Right, as like some sort of Jungian collective subconscious of like this, the rock biter from the Neverending Story or something. I don't know. Matt, did you have a take on the title of the episode?
Well, I mean, I wonder, like, if it's the Granite State, the rocks and all the rock formations in New Mexico are caused by. Are caused by what, like, not volcanic activity.
No, sedimentary activity. Though.
Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah. Which is why they have the horizontal layers, and you can see them kind of built up like a gigantic stony layer cake. And, like, granite is a different kind of rock. Yeah, so it's volcanic. So I may be overthinking it. But I wonder if there's a dichotomy like New Mexico, New Hampshire, you know, sedimentary rock, igneous rock, right? Like, I'm not sure there's anything.
Well, I mean, he is in the wrong kind of rock. Like, that's like, there's the rocks he produces, the rocks New Mexico produces, and the rocks New Hampshire produces, and whatever kind he's supposed to be, he's not in the wrong place. So that's why
he's called minerals, John.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
I mean, I think that there's something to, at least, I mean, this can be a way of looking at some of the things that happened, because what we see happen to Walt, right, is it's not like at the beginning, in the beginning of the episode, Walt is very defeated. At the end of the episode, Walt is very fired up, right? And in the intermediary space, Walt is incapable of being fired up. We even have the scene where he puts on the pork pie hat and he gets all jacked up and he's going to go out and he's going to, you know, cause a ruckus, and he can't. Right. And he won't. He looks out and he sees that Robbie, like, he's gone from Walt Whitman to Robert Frost, and he sees that long snowy road, and he can't, that's the road that no one is traveling by. And that makes all the difference. But somewhere, and this is during the Charlie Rose conversation.
You know, some say Breaking Bad will end in fire. Some say in ice.
One can do worse than be a swinger of meth. Hey, do you notice that just a very quick aside?
No, I mean, I think Fire and Ice is the poem, right? Not necessarily Birches. The Birches is...
I know, I was just mentioning. It's out. He's going to get his hand chopped off by a buzzsaw is what's going to happen. But yeah, no, it is Fire and Ice, yeah. That Song of Ice and Fire, in fact.
Now we're doing the Game of Thrones recaps again.
Yeah. No, we can't do those.
Your
yet.
Time, yeah.
I was saying, the brief aside I was saying was that the Nazis referred to meth as crank. Like, Jack referred to meth as crank at one point, yeah. Which I think was sort of showing the degree that is never, I don't think it's been referred to like that in the show. And by all means, well, actually me in the comments, but it was sort of saying like, this isn't really a meth story anymore. Like, meth isn't really all that exciting of a thing. Meth is this like awful product that if you don't have to sell it, you don't want to sell it. We're done with that kind of story. And so this reflects, if you think about sort of sediment and igneous, right? Like Walt doing the whole like, okay, you know, I need to take the money that I made doing, you know, after beating Gus Fring and becoming the meth emperor to pay for my family to be well off after I'm gone. Like this is not the base reason that Walt is doing all this stuff. And I think that's what this episode is really about. And the episode is about a lot of things, but from a character perspective, one of the things the episode is really about is getting rid of the sediment, the layers of why Walt has been doing the things that he's been doing, right? And because it's all collapsing, right? It's all falling away. And it doesn't matter that you have $80 million in a barrel or $11 million in a barrel anymore. And it doesn't matter that you beat Gus Fring. And none of this stuff matters. It doesn't even matter that you make meth, right? Like, but there is an igneous rock that's harder, right? That's like formed with the heat that built up in Walt for all those years that he was living, you know, and when Gretchen and Schwartz and all that, and the Schwartzes were off doing their thing, and Walt was seething with resentment, and his pressures were building and formed this like igneous core of self-hatred and other hatred, right? Like that is really what precipitated Walt breaking bad in the first place, right? Like, I think what we're seeing here is a broad refutation of Walt's self-constructed mythology, and going back to the basics of like, well, why does Walt break bad? And it's like, well, it's because of his feelings of inadequacy, or his feelings of whatever you want to describe it, like his just how he was betrayed in this sort of primal scene, right, between the Schwartzes. And that's the granite. Yeah, go John, go for it.
Yeah, there's the scene that kicks off the episode where Todd and Jack are talking, and like always with Breaking Bad, you look to the cold open to see what the key of the episode is going to be. Where Todd is talking about, you know, ways to improve the meth cook, and Jack stops him with a very reasonable question, like, you know, we have $80 million, why would we need to cook meth ever again? And Todd responds with a question that, you know, could have come from Walter White's mouth if Walter White were at all this self-aware, which is, no matter how much you've got, how do you turn your back on more? Which is sort of the impetus that has driven Walt these entire five seasons. And it's a sort of very dark inversion of that question, which drives Walt to the very end of the episode, which gets him to leave his lowest point, his point at which he's willing to surrender to the DEA and gets him back on the road, which is, no matter how many lives you've ruined, how can you turn your back on the opportunity to ruin two more?
So, John, you think he's going after Gretchen. What is Elliot? Elliot, right? You think he's going after Elliot? You think he's got the machine gun for Elliot and Gretchen? The next episode is just going to be him like, Gretchen and Elliot.
I don't know. Like, he's got that. He's also
got to Todd and Lydia and Applebee's, like, sharing a mucho margarita or something. Anyway.
It could end happily for them. You know, those kids deserve a chance to have it work out. They've got
the heart wants what it wants. But no, go on. Talk about Elliot and Gretchen and where you see that going.
I mean, I don't know that the machine, like, he's got the machine gun. He's also got the ricin. So I don't know that the machine, that the Modus is for them necessarily. But I mean, that's clearly what gets him out the door. Like, at the very least, he's got to make a statement. He's got to say, like, no, your story on how gray matter got started is completely wrong. And I've noted this, I think either in prior recaps or just in conversation, we never really got the complete story behind that. And that's always been a plot thread that I've been really interested to see resolved, because I've suspected for a while that that was a bit of inspirational business for Walt. And I mean, we know that there was a relationship between Walt and Gretchen, and that as a result of that, Walt and something arising from that, Walt storms off. But we don't know exactly. There's a piece we're missing somewhere, and I'm hoping we get that explained in the final episode.
Elliot's gonna like pull off his face, and it's Walt's dad. It's like, whoa! No. I just feel like we need to add levity sometimes to these things.
With it too, if it weren't for you, pesky,
Pesky
kids. Yeah, it struck me also that they really underlined the point in the scene in the bar in the Charlie Rose interview that the name of the company is related to Walt's name, and it sort of underlined the kind of the tagline for this season of "Remember My Name." Maybe it has something to do with gray matter, like Walter White in the White in Gray Matter, and not just like not just Walter White Heisenberg as a criminal name, you know, for the ages to stand up with Dillinger and Capone and Bonnie and Clyde and what have you.
And that's an interesting question. Is it that Walt is sort of still specifically sore about gray matter and wants to rectify that? Or is it that he sees what is happening with the Heisenberg name, that it's being co-opted and being used by presumably Jesse and Lydia? Walt can probably guess that's who's involved because it's in Europe, right? They mentioned that in the episode. Is it more that he's seeing what's happening with the Heisenberg name and is saying never again? right? Like, I let that happen to me once, where I let them shoulder me out, or I walked away from it, or whatever happened. I'm not going to do that this time. Or is he going to go all the way back to the beginning and try to address the primal scene where he was originally kind of screwed?
I saw it more as the former, that I think he recognizes that, like, gray matter is gone, that, like, he gave up his chance to be associated with gray matter and, like, have that empire attached to his name. But, like, watching the process of his, even in any role of his in that empire being erased, it motivates him to be like, well, my other empire I can still save. I can still preserve my role in my meth empire. I think he refers to it in the empire building episode, where he talks about how he's in the empire building business. He tells Jesse that when he gave up on gray matter, he sold his children's birthright for like a month's rent or something like that, is how he refers to it. And then in this episode, he refers to the barrels of money that Jack stole as his life's work. So I think he sees that, like, the gray matter, like, that was, like, his missed opportunity. But, like, he sees himself as being destined for some sort of greatness, that he is a great man and he needs to be recognized. And so this empire is his chance to be recognized as Heisenberg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, this is what the, oh, go ahead, John.
Well, I mean, there's the line that's often misattributed to John Steinbeck about, which isn't exactly what it's about the American poor always seeing themselves as, quote, temporarily embarrassed millionaires, that, everyone believes they're not really poor, that they have great riches and great opportunity just around the corner. And Steinbeck's point, being an ardent socialist, was that this is why there's never going to be a big revolution in America, because everyone sort of thinks they're entitled to wealth.
Well, this is why we can't. This is why we can't get, like, a sensible estate tax, right? Like, everyone thinks their estate is going to be worth $1 million one day, right? Or right, I don't know. Right. $28 million.
Probate is complicated and difficult. It involves mailing large blocks of cash in insure boxes from bars and undisclosed locations in the New Hampshire wilderness. So lawyer up, folks, when you're doing probate. But which job was that? Did you want to keep going with that?
And just one more thing. This isn't really a connection to the episode, just sort of a connection between the episode and the greater world. When I was thinking about the former tech company founder who's now sort of craggy and dissipated and living on the run in a far distant land, as sort of a refugee, but who sort of thrusts himself back into the spotlight when his tech company is under assault and tries to reassert control. I was reminded, if anyone's familiar, of the recent saga of John McAfee. If anyone's been following that.
And where did John McAfee go?
Belize!
So for those of you who haven't followed, John McAfee, founder of the company that now bears his name for the antivirus software, made millions and millions of dollars from it, say, like, countless millions, retired to Belize, lived in the sort of, like, I, to avoid being salacious, a compound of some sorts that he had in Belize, like a very nice estate in Belize, was wanted in connection to a murder that he may or may not have been involved in, went on this really weird blogging and tweeting spree while fleeing justice in Belize, and is now back in the States. The company that he helped found, McAfee Virus, has since gone on without him and is successful in its own right. His influence in it at this point is minimal, but he can still trade on the name. Like, there's, you imagine amongst the owners and shareholders and directors of McAfee Virus, there was some concern similar to what Elliot and Gretchen Schwartz have. Like, our founder's in the spotlight again. What can we do to distance ourselves from him? Do we need to address this? Should we book time on Charlie Rose?
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, this is what the Granite State was about. I think this other stuff is also totally legit. And as I said, I think it's multifaceted. But I think it's worth remembering that granite is a substance that's used in two different circumstances, in the carving of monuments and the carving of tombstones. Right, because it holds, and you carve things into it, and like marble, it's hard enough that it holds it against the weather for at least a few decades, 100 years, or whatever. So in this case, we had Ozymandias, who's the great king, and is kind of reduced to the statue, and that's the sense of the Heisenberg statue that is no longer animate, that is stationary and is sort of being looked at from all sides and enclosed and people are sort of coming farther in, the house becoming a tourist attraction. It's like the house has become a statue, right? Like a monument, yeah. What Heisenberg is doing. And at the same time, there's this whole sort of like, well, what's your epitaph going to be? What's your tombstone going to be? Like, Walt looking down that ice cold road into the woods, I felt like there were a lot of confrontations with death in this episode. You know, Jesse begging them to shoot him, right? Like wanting to die. I mean, we're saying live free or die. Like, you know, dying was very much a choice that people were looking to do. And this idea that how you go to death is also related to how you go toward fame, right? Or how you go towards notoriety, and that your name is connected with all these things, right? Yeah. And that, you know, this igneous rock within Walt is carved with his name. And he won't allow that to be, you know, wiped out, or he can't be wiped out. It's not like anyone, it's like it's in his nature. He can't not be drawn to the defense of his nomenclature, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Walt and Jesse, I mean, I think we touched on this briefly earlier, but they're at opposite points in the episode, and they cross halfway through. Like, Walt is imprisoned up in the mountains. Jesse is imprisoned in a hole below the ground. So they're at opposite, you know, ends above and below sea level, I suppose, wherever New Mexico resides. Both of them get back to ground level through immense physical exertion on their part. Jesse, through a remarkable stunt on Aaron Paul's part. I mean, just watching that, you know, I didn't see any guide wires in place, and, you know, sustaining a pull-up for that long to unlatch something is pretty physically demanding. So nice work, Aaron Paul, you know, Emmy nominee, but I don't believe winner.
And tough mutter, apparently, right?
And of course, it's tough for, you know, it's tough for a cancer victim to walk 8 miles downhill in the New Hampshire winter. And both of them are sort of forced to watch, weeping and helpless, as someone they love and someone whom they sacrifice a lot for is taken from them. You know, Jesse in the form of watching Andrea get shot, Walt in the form of having to listen helpless as Flynn, you know, cusses him out over the phone in the principal's office.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of helplessness. The Walt cutting the cards is another one, right, where Walt won't even cut the cards because he's like, able to do it. He's like, I'll do it because you're encumbered.
Yeah.
That's the word that he uses.
Right? You can't even exert that minimal minimal level of influence over his own fate to, like, change the odds that much.
See, I saw the card cutting as more a factor of, like, he has, because they had just been talking about trusting him with the money and, like, not, like, he has no choice but to trust or not trust this guy because it doesn't change anything.
Fair enough.
Like, not cutting the cards is a symbol of trust. Like, I trust you not to cheat, so I'm not going to cut the cards. But in Walt's case, it's not that he doesn't trust the guy not to cheat. It's that he can't do anything about it if he is going to cheat because he's going to be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like,
the stakes were in that game, like $1,000 a hand, maybe.
That would be pretty cool. So, what did you guys think?
It's a $10,000 game for penny stakes, right?
speaking of high stakes and feeble people, what did you think of Walt's Frodo moment when he basically thumbed his nose at everybody who had been prognosticating based on some of the things that were noticed in the Live Free or Die episode, right? Like, you guys know what I'm talking about when I say his Frodo moment?
Yeah.
When he had his thick, hairy feet and he was washing them? No.
when he decided that he would take the ring to Mordor, though he did not know the way.
Exactly. I mean, like, I don't know, I had a pretty strong, because I remember back when Live Free or Die first came out, people were picking it apart and trying to figure out what was happening. And I had two of the theories that came about. One was that Walt didn't have his wedding ring on, right? And there was the idea that, well, because Walt arranged the bacon in the 52, which was something that Skylar always did, and because he had been picking up the habits of, like, Gus Fring and, like, and Crazy Eight and various people he'd killed, there was this theory that he'd killed Skylar and assumed her name and her bacon-arranging powers and had thus, like, taken his wedding ring off, right? Then there was another theory that they saw something around his neck. They saw something in his shirt, and people thought that he was wearing a wire. Right, like he was like going in there with a machine gun to try to get the whoever he was talking to confess to some sort of crime. But it was, I mean, I don't know whether, I mean, because there were a lot of bait and switches in this episode. There was a lot of clearing away the sediment and getting down to the igneous, right? Where it's like, is Jack going to object to Todd killing that child? Nope. He's going to object to Todd not murdering Jesse. Oh, okay. In this case, it's like, did Walt murder Skylar? Like, nope, he's just too skinny to wear the wedding ring anymore, right? Like, and I mean, is it when he carries the wedding ring on the string? I mean, I it's hard for me to see that as an act of devotion to his marriage, or at least to Skylar, right? Like, I mean, something about that doesn't sit right with me. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does anybody know what I'm talking about here? Or just you guys not see the same thing there?
I know what you mean, that he's not really that tied to Skylar anymore, but he's definitely still tied to the idea of being a family man, and a family man wears his wedding ring.
Yeah.
But like being a provider, it's another one of these, I mean, it's another one of these sort of fantasies of power. And it's, you know, I don't know, it's a sort of like, this is like Walt sort of joining the Promise Keepers moment, right? Where he, you know, where it's kind of like, right, where it's kind of like the sort of like a promise that like everything will be the way it always has been, right? Like in this role of like man as provider, this kind of like very primal masculine wound that Walt seems to be suffering from and compensating for all the time can be rectified or can be healed. This sort of like lack that he perceives or that he experiences somehow can be made up for by virtue of will, or like by virtue of like recommitting to the first place. But this is a season where sort of the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are very, you know, are very important, you know, become very become foundational for us, become the way that we manage to go on.
Yeah. It's far more important for Walt to identify with the role as provider than it is for him to actually provide. It's far more important to identify than to execute.
That's right. You know, and it's something like, it's like one of the tenets of a certain kind of feminist criticism, right? That like the goal of phallogocentrism is to replace the penis with the phallus, right?
Can you explain that a little bit, just to people who aren't as well versed in phallogocentrism as we, of course, all are?
To replace an actual physical reality, which is not particularly special, it's just an organ, right? Just a body part. And you know, if popular culture has taught us anything, it's that parts is parts. With a like a quasi mythical locus of power, you know what I mean? With a sort of traditional kind of male domination, as though it were centered in biology, right? As though it were centered in the kind of the sex characteristics that make you the sex that you are. And to take a shrug your shoulders, happenstance physical reality and turn it into like an eternal myth for the ages. And that's why, I'm trying to underline the point that John is making, which I agree with, which is that like, he doesn't have to provide, he has to be a provider.
Exactly. This is more Egyptian stuff too. It's like the Komos, all the obelisks. What you're basically saying is that the granite state is Walt's penis.
Well, that Walt's penis, yeah, it's in the granite state, like the rest of Walt, you know, at all the time. I don't know. Did anyone? I mean, while we've gone from the sublime to the ridiculous, did you ever see Hank as a kind of personified phallus, right? Like with his shiny bald head and his explosive energy and his, you know, I don't know.
Too soon. But I know what you mean. He's very
natural. I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's, I don't mean to make light of the death of Hank, which was like profoundly affecting for me when I saw it. But, did the death of Andrea hit you the same way?
No, it hit me in the back of the head as opposed to right in the face.
Well, I mean, because if anything, it ought to be, more devastating because Andrea was, not a police officer, right? And she had not just been involved in a bust and a shootout with a prison gang, right? Like she was just you know, minding her own business on her porch and actually caring about, still, you know, continuing to care about this guy who brought a lot of misery into her life and also money.
It's literally her love of Jesse that gets her out the door. Like, not to ascribe too much necessary paranoia for single mothers, but you tend to be pretty well trained not to open the door to strange people. And she has the door chained at first, but it's literally her love of Jesse that gets her out the door with her back to this stranger. And
right, you know, one of the few instances of in this episode of a barrier being, you know, another instance of like a prison cell in the house with the chain and a barrier that's sort of opened, and sort of what the need for or the consequence of kind of containment or barriers to keep in or to keep out, and what happens when they're breached, right? Like, yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
No, that's it. Okay. That's all I got.
But I also wanted to point out, and I want to jump forward to some predictions real soon, but I want to point out that this is, I think, Matt, I think you just identified one of the levers in which Breaking Bad operates just in general, which is that you have these ideas about who you might sympathize with more based on whether they're like a better or worse person, or they're more or less deserving, or they've got a social role that you feel like should be treated in a certain way, when we are instead confronted with people that we can identify with and we can sympathize with and connect with. There's a lot of frustrating shortcomings in moral self-conception, other conception, right? Where like we will sympathize with the terrible person that doesn't need our sympathy, because it's about connecting between people and the sort of women and children first, all the other things that we do to set up these abstract rules for governing who we ought to care about. Well, the heart wants what the heart wants, right? Like, and the heart wanted to care more about Hank than it did about Andrea, because we knew Hank and Hank meant something to us, and Andrea was a fairly minor character. It was Jane, I'd be torn apart, because Jane was a more major character. I felt like I knew her better. Like, Andrea was always kind of peripheral, and I never really felt like I got to know her, like, sort of intimately. And I think that was by design, because their life was private. You know, Jesse and Andrea and Brock, they kind of were on their own. The story wasn't really about them. And that it was about how they could never be their own thing, and they kept getting pulled back in, or just kept pulling away. But anyway, we're coming up on an hour, and this has been awesome. But I gotta go across the board and ask: does anybody? I know we talked a little bit before about Gretchen Schwartz Apocalypse 2013, when the machine guns are going to be firing at the Gray Matter offices. But seriously, we got one more episode of this. We got one more shot of whiskey left in the glass. What do you guys? What do you think is going to happen? Do you think Shane is going to come back? That would be my favorite thing that would happen. Not that you guys aren't awesome. I love you guys, and I love that you're here, but she was my favorite character on these recaps, except for that John guy, who's also pretty awesome. But no, never mind. I'm glad
all the new characters. I don't see much more happening.
No, is her story's done? She's not coming back? No.
It's that John character.
That John character is awesome. I love that John character. He's great. I hope he lives through the end of the Breaking Bad recaps. I don't want to start killing off characters. No, knock on wood. Too soon. Guys, what is going to happen in Felina? Come on. Nobody?
So okay. The one thing we haven't seen this season that's like the hallmark of Breaking Bad is science. Science. You know, doing something crazy with like a clever plan. And so I think we have to see some of that in this last episode. Whether it comes from Walt or Jesse, I'm not sure. I'm inclined to think it's Jesse, only because that's his only card he has left to play. Like, clearly he's not going to pick the lock again. Like, they're going to fix that. But he still has access to a meth lab with, like, a lot of chemicals in it. So I could definitely see, like, and that would be a callback to the first episode, if he used the chemicals to create, to like somehow get his revenge on the Nazis, like create some huge meth lab explosion. Because even if it kills him, like, he's probably okay with that at this point. He just like wants his bloody revenge. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see that resurgent. But that said, I think Jesse's going to survive. That's my bold pick. Just because this is a show where probably everybody dies, but I think Jesse's going to live out. I think Vince Gilligan is going to give us that, but I probably shouldn't be that confident.
Matt, do you have any predictions?
I shudder to think. I don't know. Yeah, I want to keep my hand out of this one. I mean, does Walt live or die? Does Jesse live or die? Does Lydia ever find some extra stevia for her tea? I don't know. Tune in.
Walt will give her some.
Yeah.
I bet you somebody puts the ricin in a sugar packet and Lydia doesn't take it because she insists on stevia, and Walt doesn't know that Lydia likes stevia, or does he? Maybe he does. I don't remember. Yeah. Maybe some guy named Steve shows up. Maybe it's been foreshadowing this whole time that Todd and Steve have to battle it out for her heart.
All right. My prediction.
Okay.
Huel takes charge of the car wash. Ted Beneke comes back and picks up the meth cooking business, because what else is he going to do? And Marie poses as an eccentric millionaire and adopts both Lydia and Brock's kids, or Lydia and Andrea's kids.
All right. My prediction is that the last episode is a shot-for-shot remake of Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium.
Two copies.
So, do you have any predictions? What do you think is going to happen? What do you think about all we've been talking about? What does the granite state mean to you? Is it an emotional state? Is it a physical state? Is it a state of the union? Is it, you know, what do you think about the 2016 primaries? No, we're not talking about that, New Hampshire. No, people. But we are talking about everything else. Right. So if you want to have conversations about this, about Breaking Bad's legacy in general, you want to talk about binge watching with Rather, you want to talk about being the aspiring to be Saul Goodman someday with Ben. You want to talk about ice cream with me and John and our differing viewpoints on its relative importance and excellence in the world. You know where to find us, which is to please visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve. So Rather, that was a good podcast from you. You did real good today. So I got you. I got some Chunky Monkey, and I got some Cherry Garcia. I didn't know which one you liked. So just take whichever one you want.
Put it in the bucket and lower it down to me.
Shoot!
It puts the ice cream in the bucket.